Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Web at helpstophunger.org. From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. American soldiers among the Iraq war wounded are not greeted with fanfare when they return to the United States. They fly in late at night on transports from medical facilities in Europe. They are moved quietly to military hospitals around the country and then home. But the number of U.S. troops wounded in Iraq is climbing steadily, and their stories demand hearing. Tonight on Point, saving lives and living wounded in the battle for Iraq. But first, good news in the Department of Labor's October report today. Unemployment fell by 0.1% to 6% nationally last month, as 126,000 new workers were hired. The economy has now added jobs 3 months in a row, the first time since late 2000 that this has happened. Greg Ipp is economics reporter for The Wall Street Journal. I asked him if the numbers indicate that the long hiring slump is over.
This is excellent news. I think that this is strong evidence that, in fact, the jobless recovery is about to become a jobs recovery.
Break it down for us. Where are jobs showing up, new jobs?
We created about 143,000 jobs in the month of October in the services sector. In the goods-producing sector, it was still a bit weak. We lost 24,000 jobs in manufacturing. But that's quite a lot less than we'd been losing in the prior 2 or 3 years. And so I don't think it'll be too long before we start to see jobs created in the manufacturing sector, especially because we have lots of evidence that business is picking up a lot in the industrial sector.
But services already going strong. Do the numbers break it down? Where in the service industries jobs are being created most quickly?
Sure. We continue to have very strong growth in the education and health services area. No news there. But we picked up 30,000 jobs in retail trade. That's very positive because it means that the consumer is out there spending. And we picked up 10,000 jobs in government. And as a lot of us know, there have been a lot of job cuts in terms of state and local governments dealing with their budget crises. So there might be relief on that front as well.
And how about the number of people looking for part-time work because they can't find full-time work?
Well, that continues to be a bit discouraging, Tom. The unemployment rate at 6% did come down a tick, but if you actually added back all the people who have stopped looking for work but would like to have a job if they found one, the unemployment rate would be more like 9%, and that would be still up from, say, 8.6% this time last year. So there continues to be a very difficult time out there for those who don't have jobs. I mean, notwithstanding that this is a very good sign for the economy, it still comes after 2 years of exceptional weakness. We are in the early stages of an improvement in the labor market. We are by no means hitting on all cylinders. But again, I don't want to downplay the very good news here. Even on something that's been a source of considerable concern in recent months, the fact that the average unemployed person has been without a job for a very long time, there's improvement there. In October, the average unemployed person had gone without a job for 19 weeks, and back in June it was almost 20 weeks.
Greg, how many jobs per month does the economy need to create to keep up simply with the growth of the labor force?
Tom, that's a good question. Of course, it's very good news that we created 126,000 jobs in the month of October, but that's roughly how many jobs you have to create just to keep up with population growth, never mind to use up all the people who are already unemployed and looking for work. So we need a much better rate of job creation than this to bring down the unemployment rate. At 6%, it's still probably at least a percentage point higher than what most economists would regard as a good long-term stable unemployment rate for the economy.
But even so, people are talking about the potential that the longest hiring slump in more than 60 years may be ending. Greg, when people look back on that long slump, what do you think they'll point to as the main causes of poor hiring in all those years?
I think that they'll point to two things, one temporary and one long-term. The temporary factor is that we just had a lot of things hurting business confidence in the last year or two. We had the terrorist attacks, we had the corporate governance scandals, we had the war in Iraq. A lot of companies were just very reluctant to add to their payrolls because they didn't know how sales were going to be 6 months from now. The other factor, though, is more long-term, and that factor is that we've had an extraordinary improvement in productivity. Companies have just found many creative ways to produce more with the same number or fewer workers. And a colleague of mine wrote an article in today's paper about how, for example, you can now play The Marriage of Figaro with a much smaller orchestra than you could 200 years ago. Just one small example of how you can do a lot more with less. And so the bottom line there was that even though the economy was growing for the last year or two, businesses were finding ways to meet those increased sales without actually adding to their payrolls. Now, eventually, those increased sales add to your profits, and businesses become bold enough to expand. And when they expand, they will need to hire more people. That's what I think we are seeing now.
We just got the big new GDP numbers that came out with very hot growth in the third quarter. Now these better employment figures. What's the ripple-through effect of these things? For example, will we see higher interest rates soon?
If we have a few more quarters of strong job growth like this, yes, I don't think there's any question that the Federal Reserve will start to send signals that the 1% interest rate that they've been maintaining for some time now cannot stay there. But I also wouldn't expect it to happen next month or even the month after that. Remember, inflation is still very low. It's at about 1%. And because there remains a lot of unused business capacity and because unemployment is still higher than it ought to be, there's a lot of downward pressure on prices and wages. So the main thing that the Fed tries to control, that is to say inflation, is not giving it any reasons yet and will not for quite a few months to raise interest rates.
But overall, between these new growth numbers and these new hiring numbers, it's beginning to look like a pretty good gangway for George Bush to an election season next fall.
That's right, Tom. He's got another year before he has to go back to the polls, and by the time he does, assuming that everything unfolds as the script calls for, we could have very nice job growth numbers and the unemployment rate dipping below 6% on a sustainable basis. But let's not jump to conclusions too quickly. A lot of things could still go wrong. We don't know how much of that very strong growth over the summertime was a one-shot deal related to the tax cuts, which took effect in that period, and the last big wave of refinancings as mortgage rates hit briefly their lowest level since the 1960s. We don't have those benefits in the coming months, and so can we reproduce that sort of performance? We don't know yet.
We'll be watching. Greg, thanks for joining us.
All right, Tom. It's always a pleasure.
Greg Ipp is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He spoke with me from Washington. Advances in Army field medicine and evacuation speed mean that more U.S. soldiers are surviving injuries in the war in Iraq. In World War II, one out of three soldiers wounded died. In Vietnam and the Gulf War, one out of four. In Iraq, just one in eight. The higher survival rate keeps the death toll down, a blessing for troops and national morale. But the wounded have another fight ahead. These men and women return home with bodies often radically changed by bullets, by shrapnel, by mortar fire, by RPGs and landmines. Some come home without sight, some without limbs, and their struggles go on long after the battle. Struggles for hope, for strength, for recuperation. Tonight on Point, saving lives and living with wounds in and after Iraq. Have the U.S. troops wounded in the Iraq conflict been invisible to you? Should wounded numbers be posted alongside the numbers of those killed in action? And how do you feel? How do you fully calculate the cost of a war? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington, D.C. is Mark Thompson, national security correspondent for Time magazine. He's the author of The Wounded Come Home in this week's edition of Time. Good evening and welcome, Mark Thompson.
Good evening, Tom.
Thanks for joining us, Mark. Mark, I wonder if you could give us the big picture here in terms of numbers. There's the very steady reporting on the death toll, and there have been some very dramatic events between the Chinook coming down, the Black Hawk helicopter coming down just today. People seem to know where the death toll stands, but what is the number of wounded? How does it compare?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, prior to May 1st, when the president declared that major combat operations were over, there was roughly, I don't know, one injured for every one killed or two injured for every one killed. But since May 1st, the number of injured has gone up considerably relative to those killed. And we're now talking about some 2,000 soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines. Many of them have been wounded quite grievously and have had to come back to the United States for help. But some, of course, have been only mildly wounded and are able to return to their units after several days in a field hospital.
So, Mark, you've done a lot of reporting on this, but the simple awareness of the wounded in Iraq seems to be hard to keep on top of. The military does not publicize the number of wounded, do they?
Well, that is a particular bugaboo of mine because I've covered the military for a long time, and in the last 10 years, the Pentagon has created one of the best websites in the world today. It is a wealth of information. Everything from the Secretary of Defense's quote of the day to menus at various base cafeterias and mess halls around the world. Yet, you cannot find anywhere on that website how many Americans were wounded in Iraq yesterday or the day before. The only thing the military will tell you is, if you call Central Command Headquarters in Tampa, Florida, what is the total number of wounded as of today? So what you've got to do is call every day and do the subtraction to figure out the gain. Our government will not tell us how many Americans were wounded in Iraq in April and how many were wounded in May. And to me, that's just, you know, I'm a taxpayer, not only a reporter. I think our government owes us that answer, and it's quite frustrating when they won't tell us.
I guess given the thoroughness of their information operation, that is a deliberate decision to keep those numbers low profile. Why exactly, Mark Thompson?
Well, I don't know. I mean, let's face it. They do tabulate the numbers. They have them. And if you, as a reporter or even a citizen, I imagine, called Tampa, they would tell you the number right now. It changes at 10 a.m. every morning. So they've got it. They just don't want to post it. I presume it's not good news. You know, there is no publicity that comes along with being wounded in Iraq. If you are killed, a terse press release is issued announcing your death. And then generally, one, two, three, or four days later, another press release comes out with your name. If someone is injured with you when you die, they will note that someone was injured in this event in which you were killed. But if you do not die, if someone does not die, those attacks may not as well be happening. And I do think that leads the American people somewhat astray because they have no idea about all of the attacks that are going on in which deaths do not result.
Mark, take us into the field then, in a sense, into the picture in Iraq. How are these wounds occurring? And we heard earlier that these ratios, much better in Iraq than in earlier wars, of those who are wounded surviving. So that means greater numbers of wounded. But what's the reality that soldiers are facing in the field? Where do the wounds come from?
Well, I mean, obviously, we are not having a tip of the spear hitting the tip of the spear. You know, basically, these are thugs or terrorists taking on our soldiers. They are using the so-called IEDs, improvised explosive devices, which basically are mines that can be set off when a Humvee goes by or even a tank, which has happened recently. And a bad guy with a cell phone or a radio device can make it detonate when the Humvee goes by, but not when an Iraqi vehicle goes by. Similarly, you have the rocket-propelled grenades, which are basically a World War II era weapon, but still are capable of doing an awful lot of harm. I mean, that's the sort. It's not, you know, there is no artillery by the Iraqis because there is no Iraqi military really left, and there is no Iraqi air power. So you're left with these weapons that can hurt the Americans in this case, in onesies and twosies, not in huge numbers. This could be the case with air power or artillery.
And they're not massed battle formations in any case. But we have the sense that between armored personnel carriers and the big Humvees and all the body armor that we hear about in Iraq, that the soldiers should be better protected than they ever have been.
Well, they are. I mean, indeed, they are. That is a true statement. But some are also being wounded. I mean, when you talk to military people who served in Afghanistan, that was the first conflict where this new body armor with the ceramic plates in the front of the back of the Kevlar vests was used. And people were getting shot at, getting knocked over by an AK-47 slug, which is a big bullet, and then standing up and living to talk about it. That's absolutely incredible. That never existed before. What you're seeing instead are folks who are being damaged in their extremities, in their arms and their legs, which cannot be protected to any degree if you want to maintain some mobility.
So is the pattern of wounds different from earlier conflicts because of that body armor?
Yeah, very definitely. There recently was a presentation made to a group of emergency physicians by somebody at Bethesda Naval Hospital who said that, you know, we are seeing far more wounds to the extremities in this conflict and consequently and sadly far more amputations.
Meaning in earlier wars they might have simply died. Now they'll come out of it but with maybe missing an arm or a leg or more.
Right. I mean, with the better suits and the quicker evacuation to medical facilities, in the olden days, you get hit in the chest, you would die. Now you get hit in the chest, you don't die. And in fact, you can keep fighting. If you get hit in a limb, you're less likely nowadays to bleed to death on the battlefield because of the various improvements that have been made. But you have lost that limb, and it's not going to be reattached.
Mark Thompson, stand by. We're going to come back and talk with medical personnel who've worked in the field in Iraq and with U.S. soldiers who have been wounded and lived to tell us about it. We're talking tonight about the Iraq War wounded, the other casualty number from that war. Have the U.S. troops wounded in the Iraq conflict been invisible to you? And should wounded numbers be made public right alongside the killed in action? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Iraq War wounded, the other casualty number from the war. You can join our conversation tonight. Have the wounded been off your radar screen in this conflict? Did you think that body armor meant invulnerability? And do the stories of the war wounded in Iraq change your sense of the cost and benefit of the Iraq War or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I've been talking with Mark Thompson. He's national security correspondent for Time magazine. We're joined now from Fort Campbell, Kentucky, by Lieutenant Colonel Kirby Gross. He had a private surgery practice before joining the Army in July of 2002. He was there for the invasion of Iraq, served with the 86th Combat Support Hospital, and has seen firsthand the kind of effort that goes into saving lives in Iraq. Good evening and welcome, Lieutenant Colonel Kirby Gross.
Hey, good evening.
Good evening. Thanks for joining us. Colonel, I wonder if you can give us some sense of the advances that have made the rate of death in Iraq so much lower than earlier wars, even much lower than the Gulf War just a decade ago.
Well, the body armor is a very major factor in the improved survivorship of our casualties. It's a very major factor.
So just for starters, it's that big vest that we see essentially covering the torso.
Yes, with the ceramic plate reinforcement. Yes, sir.
And what about the helmets? Are they the same helmets they've had before? Are they as impervious as the vest, as the abdominal and torso armor?
The Kevlar helmets that we wear are very effective in terms of protecting a well-placed wounding effort to the helmet. We wouldn't have as much protection, but certainly they're much improved over in the past.
And what about the medicine that's being deployed, the techniques being deployed in the field, Colonel Gross? How's that helping to push down the number of deaths?
Well, we are positioning our medical personnel close to the site of the combat, which in terms of trauma, it's so important to be able to provide resuscitative surgery, provide skilled caregivers close to the time of wounding. And that's had a positive impact and outcome as well.
Mark Thompson, you write about the so-called golden hour after the time that a soldier is hit. If they can get to good medical facilities within 1 hour, their chances of surviving are greatly increased. But you also write that soldiers can bleed to death very, very quickly, Mark Thompson.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that I learned in reporting this story was that, as I'm sure Colonel Gross can attest, if you lose a limb, you're going to bleed to death really quickly. And that's one of the most neat things I learned over the past month was the military has a potion, basically, that comes from Connecticut, something called Quick Clot, which is just a pumice-like powder that a soldier can sprinkle on his own gaping wound, and the bleeding stops instantly. Now, there's a lot of – it's not quite as cool as that, but the military has records that say that 23 people who otherwise would have died were saved because they didn't bleed to death because they had this stuff. And that's just a fantastic addition to any medic's kit.
Colonel Gross, did you witness the use of the Quick Clot, the blood-stopping agent in the field in Iraq?
No, sir, I didn't. I knew it was available. I knew it was available to our soldiers to be applied. The casualties I encountered did not, that was not employed, did not see that specific wound as described, where it would have some application. The Army has invested much in research for these wounds, which do require some hemostatic agents. One thing that's also been identified in combat casualties are the risk of exsanguinating wounds. And so something in civilian trauma, which is rarely discussed, is that of use of tourniquets, whereas in combat trauma, tourniquets are something which can be employed and should be employed, in part because the length of time between wounding and access to medical care is longer, generally, in combat trauma as opposed to civilian trauma. For example, in civilian trauma, we discuss evacuation times measured in terms of minutes between the time EMS is called and the casualty is taken to the trauma center. Of course, the wounding forces are much less than civilian trauma. So there are some very specific differences between combat trauma and civilian trauma.
Another of the innovations we read about is the one-handed tourniquet, which a soldier can apply to him or herself, even if they only have one hand available to do it. Apparently that's an advance.
Yes, it is. Yes, sir.
And bandages made with a chemical derived from shrimp shells that also speed blood clotting.
Correct. This is similar to the agent Mr. Thompson described, the goal being to effect hemostasis, a wound which a significant amount of blood can be lost, but with which would not be amenable to tourniquet application. Applications, these agents with pressure certainly decreases significantly the amount of blood loss.
As a surgeon with the military, Colonel Gross, do you talk with your peers, with the commanding officers there, about the morale implications of wounding? The number of dead is driven down, but you've got, in a sense, more wounded in the ratio, kind of as a result. It sounds, on the one hand, it's terrific. You don't want to see people dying. On the other hand, you're dealing with living soldiers and all of their problems. What are the relative morale implications there?
Well, certainly the implications for us as healthcare providers is to do everything we can for our wounded soldiers. Impacts us as an Army medical department is to be as attentive, as conscientious, to ensure that we have the very best possible rehabilitative programs available.
Mark Thompson, let me put the same question to you, and I'm not sure I'm expressing it well, but you know what I'm getting at. There's a different impact. I mean, body bags are terrible. Killed in action is the worst. Yet there's a different kind of impact, I would think, from significant numbers of wounded and seeing them have to deal with that.
Yeah, I mean, soldiers I have spoken with in this conflict and earlier ones, if someone is shot at and goes back to his unit, maybe he's not even wounded at all. But that has an impact on morale. I mean, because he's been targeted, even if the bad guy missed. If the bad guy hits and wounds mildly, that has a bigger impact on morale. But, you know, thankfully, the fellow hasn't lost the use of his arms or legs and is able to go out again in a day or two. But whenever there's a casualty, it definitely affects morale. And in the beginning, you can sort of see that it convinces soldiers that this is real. Mm-hmm. But it very quickly reaches a point where they begin to hunker down a little bit more based on the places I've gone and the soldiers I've spoken with. And they do hunker down more. They are less out there because they realize that they face the possibility of being picked off. And I think I'm hearing that and seeing that in Iraq right now.
We're talking tonight about the other casualty number from the war in Iraq, the war wounded numbers. We're at 1-800-423-8255. John's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hello. How are you guys doing today?
Just great.
I have one quick question really regarding the long-term cost of the injured. Wondering if the reason that we're not showing these costs is because we're not given a chance. We don't want to give a chance to the people to see what happens to the injured after the war and the long-term effect that it has on their morale and the Army's morale.
So you're thinking of public perception outside the military on the home front, John?
Yes, I am.
Mark Thompson, what's your sense of that?
Well, definitely. I mean, in today's world, what Americans expect of medical care is so much higher than it was even a generation ago. And I went to the VA 10 or 15 days ago and said, listen, I've got three fellows who lost their legs in a single event. They're all in their 20s. They're all low-ranking soldiers. How much is that going to cost the U.S. taxpayer over the course of their expected lifespan? I'm still waiting for that answer.
Well, but what about this war overall in terms of its impact on the VA system? Is it up for it? I mean, we read the reports in October, this kind of scandal coming out of Fort Stewart in Georgia, where troops have come back. They've been in lousy barracks waiting for weeks, even months, to see a doctor.
But that's the military, not the VA, Tom, and there is a big difference.
Okay.
I mean, the VA has lots of unused hospitals. Bed space is not their problem. Plainly, funding always is. But, you know, the VA budget is up there at $50 billion or something. They've got plenty of money.
So this, what we're seeing coming out of Iraq, isn't a budget breaker for them. They're in a position to deal with it long term.
Yeah, I mean, this nation can always pay for its war wounded.
Well, one would hope so. Colonel Groves, Mark Thompson, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Sergeant Gary Boggs. He joins us from Marion, Ohio. Sergeant with the National Guard, served active duty with the 1st Brigade of the 4th Infantry Division in Fort Hood, deployed to Iraq via Kuwait in April 2003. Good evening and welcome, Sergeant Gary Boggs. Hello, Gary Boggs, are you there?
Yes.
Good evening. Thanks very much for joining us, Sergeant Boggs. Gary Boggs, are you there?
Yes, I'm glad to be here today.
Oh, we're delighted to have you. Gary Boggs, you ran into your own wounding problems in Iraq, September 26th in Tikrit. Can you tell us what happened and what kind of treatment you got?
Basically, our vehicle was traveling out of our compound, where I was actually heading on an R&R trip to get a couple days of rest and relaxation, and our vehicle struck and drove by an IED, which was command detonated.
This is one of these improvised explosive devices, kind of homemade bombs by the road.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. What were you driving in, Sergeant Boggs?
We were in a cargo Humvee, and I was in the back pulling security.
And how close were you to the explosion?
We were right in the left lane, so we were actually pretty close. We didn't drive up on it, but it was close enough to do considerable damage to the vehicle.
Did you see it coming at all, or was it just a blast out of nowhere?
It was a blast out of nowhere. It was actually buried in the ground.
And what happened, Gary Boggs, with that blast?
We had a total of 5 people in the vehicle. 3 were wounded, mine being the worst injuries. I ended up taking shrapnel pretty much the left side of my body, including my eye, which I ended up losing my eyesight out of it, and considerable shrapnel my left arm, which I still have some in there. And both my eardrums are ruptured as well.
So tell us how you've been on the repair front. Do you have your hearing back?
It's slowly healing. It's basically, my eardrums, they said it's going to take about probably like 6 to 7 weeks. As far as everything else, I've actually come along quite well.
How about the shrapnel? Where was that removed? In the field back in Baghdad in Germany?
I had actually shrapnel removed from my eye in Baghdad, and then I actually had some removed once I got to Landstuhl, Germany.
So most of that is gone, but your eye you've essentially lost.
Correct. When I was in Walter Reed Hospital, they ended up removing my left eye, and I'm eventually going to get fitted with a prosthetic eye.
How are you dealing with that, Gary Boggs? How do you find it? Is it a whole new world? Is it not too bad? What's your experience been?
I mean, just being at Walter Reed, seeing a lot of the other soldiers, I consider myself pretty lucky and fortunate. I lost my eye, but after being home, I've found I could do everything I did before, so I'm making the best with what I have, and I'm pretty happy with it. I mean, you know, I hate losing it, but it could have been a lot worse.
Sergeant Boggs, how old are you?
I'm 28.
And when did you join the military?
I joined it back in 96.
And when you joined, did you go in with full awareness that this might be part of the package?
Yes, I did.
So what are your feelings now on the other side of the wound and the sacrifice you've made in Iraq?
I mean, I would go back over again. I feel that we're doing a lot of good over there. I mean, I personally, one of my part of the job I did over there, I worked with civil affairs, which, you know, we had our hands in a lot of rebuilding of schools. I mean, providing water to villages that never had it. So I got to see a lot of progress over there while I was there. So I feel we're doing a really good job over there.
So there's a kind of satisfaction in spite of the price you've paid.
Correct. I mean, I made a lot of good friends and stuff over there, actually. I mean, I was having a good time up until the accident, really.
Gary Boggs, can you stay with us while we talk with some of our callers?
Yes.
Josephine's calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Josephine. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm pleased to be on the air, and thank you. You always have such a wonderful show.
It's good to have you.
My concern, and it's been all along, and I'm so happy that this is being aired. I just wish it was other than a Friday night. My concern is about the wounded long term. A gentleman indicated that there'd always be funding for the war wounded, and I think that's probably true in the short term and as long as they are in the service. My concern is what happens when they are discharged from the service and they go out seeking jobs. And my concern is that there will be few job opportunities, perhaps. And even if they're able to find jobs in some areas of the country, such as the Northeast, where housing is such a problem.
So you're looking down the road at the economic impact of an injury in war.
Right.
Let's pick that up. Josephine, thank you very much for your call. Mark Thompson, what about it? How does the military define its long-term responsibility to a soldier wounded in war? Right across the board from medical care to economic issues.
Well, the military does, under the government umbrella, hand off responsibility to the VA. And the VA then picks up that ball and is supposed to provide veterans, especially injured veterans, with all sorts of care and consideration.
But does it extend beyond medical care? What about economic issues? What if a wound in war makes it more difficult for someone to make the kind of living they'd like? What then?
Well, plainly, you can get a disability pension. You know, Jessica Lynch, the famous POW from Iraq, has been retired at 80% of her basic pay. She will continue to get that for the rest of her life. And other people who have been injured, not by because they were POWs, but just on the battlefield, are eligible also for such disability payments.
Sergeant Boggs in Marion, Ohio, what's your understanding? You've lost an eye in the war in Iraq. Is there a long-term commitment that the military, the government has to you as a result or not?
Yes, there is, actually. I haven't really started that process yet, just but like talking to my ophthalmologist, he said, just from losing my eye, I'm going to get at least 50% disability pay.
50% military disability pay.
Correct, and I will get medical treatment for the rest of my life, not just through VA, but like any military hospital as well.
Right, and have you left the military now, or are you still active duty? But
I will still be on active duty until everything is said and done. Even when I go back to my National Guard unit, I will still remain on active duty status until everything's done. And also, I just like the lady was talking about jobs and stuff. I've actually, just in my National Guard, I've already had, offers like civilian, like as a government contractor. So, I mean, everyone's been really helpful. I mean, I'm not even worried about, once this is done, they're just going to, forget about me. Everyone's been very helpful.
So you've been well received on that front. Sergeant Boggs, what are your thoughts about your mates who are still back in Iraq? They are still facing the kind of danger that hit you.
I keep updated with them daily via email and stuff, just so I can follow it a lot better, have a better understanding.
And are they fearful of being wounded, or they must be. I mean, they're human.
I mean, up until my accident, I mean, you never really when you go out there, you never really think about it. I can remember one time when I was actually afraid, and that was the initial, when we drove up to Kuwait, we heard that, our convoy was taking fire, but we actually weren't taking it, so it actually gave us time to, think about it. Other than that, that was really the only time I was really afraid. I mean, even with my accident, it happened so quick, you really didn't have time to really think about it. You just kind of, snap into your training and just do what you're supposed to do.
Gary Boggs, thank you very much for joining us tonight, and our respect to you for your sacrifice.
Thank you.
Sergeant Gary Boggs lost his eye on September 26th in Tikrit. We're talking about the other casualty number from the war wounded. We're at 1-800-423. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Iraq War wounded, the other casualty number from that war. You can join the conversation. Are you confident that the country will make the right long-term commitment to their care? Are Iraq war wounded starting to show up in your town? And how do you fully calculate the cost of a war, of the dead, of the wounded. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I've been joined tonight by Mark Thompson, National Security Correspondent for Time Magazine. He joins us from Washington. And from Fort Campbell, Kentucky, Army Surgeon Lieutenant Colonel Kirby Gross. He served in Iraq through June this year. We're joined now on the line by Neil, calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, Neil. You're on the air.
Hello there.
Good evening.
I'm going to try to get through this, Tom. I found out 2 hours ago that my brother just died in Iraq.
In what circumstances, Neil?
He flew the Black Hawk helicopter that was shot down.
The one that went down today in Tikrit?
Correct.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. How did you find out?
My family notified me.
What's your brother's name, Neil?
Karen Kennedy.
How old was he?
He was 43.
How long had he been in Iraq?
He'd been in Iraq since they went in. He was with the 101st Airborne.
And are you sure that it was him, that it was his chopper? Are you sure that this is what's happened?
They notified his wife.
Neil, I'm sorry. We're talking about wounded, and of course...
And I know you are, and all I wanted to make for a point, the cost of taking care of our wounded is worth whatever it costs. I'd take them back wounded. Anytime, at any cost.
I'm sure you would.
I'm sorry.
No, Neil, it's... It's good to hear from you. It's a devastating loss, and there are not the right words for it. And this is the day that you've learned. But it's good to hear from you, to be reminded of just what the costs are. I'm sorry that your family and your brother have had to pay that price today, but thank you for calling.
Whatever it costs for our wounded, it's worth it for what these men and women are doing.
Neil, good luck to you and your family and to your brother's family. Our prayers go with all of you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling. Well, I don't know what to say to that, except that is a very real reminder of what wars cost. And our heart goes out to that family today. Ernie's calling from North Truro, Massachusetts. Ernie, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I think that there is another statistic which is really being concealed. Every time there is an incident, we hear about the deaths and the number of wounded, and then the subject of the wounded is dropped. Now, if 1 in 8 or whatever the number is, a certain number of the wounded must die, you never hear and die later. That figure is never given out, to my knowledge. I've never heard it. Except the one instance where the copter, they upped the figure from 15 to 16 when they said one of the wounded died. But other than that, you never hear of the wounded dying.
Yeah, that's a good question, Ernie. Thanks for raising it. Mark Thompson, how about it? If wounded eventually die, does that number get added to the death toll of a war, of this war?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I get all these emails from Central Command and the Pentagon, and they're very depressing to see them load up. And oftentimes you will see that, Specialist Joe Blow died today. He was wounded 14 days ago in Iraq. You do see that. I mean, reporters are innately curious about, are they hiding deaths? And I must say, one of the reasons I'm particularly perturbed by the Pentagon's policy on wounded is because, to the best of my knowledge, they do a pretty credible job of keeping the public informed about the deaths of American soldiers, and I give them credit for that. I've not found any indication or any hint that they've shied away from that, contrary to what they're doing vis-a-vis the wounding.
And, Mark, I want to give you a chance to respond to the call we just had before Ernie to Neil, whose brother was apparently the pilot of the Black Hawk helicopter that went down today. I mean, this reminds us that for all the wounds, and they can be terrible, the real cost, the ultimate price, comes in death, and there's been plenty of that.
Yeah, as we talked about earlier, Tom, I mean, once you get aircraft involved in a war, the death comes much more surely and much more swiftly And that is causing some concern in the Pentagon, is a crewed surface-to-air missile, perhaps an SA-7, or a crewed rocket-propelled grenade like was used against the Black Hawk apparently today. Once that happens and once that makes contact with the aircraft, there isn't a whole lot that can be done.
Mark, you describe in your Time magazine piece a particular ambush that took place on August 25th and three men who were wounded in that ambush. Can you describe what went on there for us?
Well, yeah. I mean, in a nutshell, these folks were in an M113, what they call a battle taxi, a tracked vehicle, going down Route 10 in the Sunni Triangle, pretty close to Baghdad and close to Fallujah, the current hot spot. They were just driving along like they'd done many times before, when from the left over their head, they heard first, and then they saw a rocket-propelled grenade come at them from the left. There were a total of three of these vehicles. They all turned to the left off the road to try to hunt down the people who had shot this rocket-propelled grenade at them, while one of these vehicles was stopped, sort of getting ready to go over an earthen berm. Another RPG came apparently from another direction through the back of the M113. And like a meat cleaver, it severed three men's legs. Three men each lost a leg. Then the RPG went through the radiator, lodged in the front of the M113's engine, and did not blow up. Because it did not blow up, they lived. But they had these horrific wounds.
And in that M113 were Tristan Wyatt, Private First Class, Sergeant Eric Castro, and Sergeant Mike Minan. Is that right?
That's correct.
Now, they were all evacuated, but they took some very difficult incoming fire right there in that ambush. Mike Minan, the sergeant who was among those three, joins us this evening from Colorado Springs, Colorado. Good evening and welcome, Sergeant Mike Minan.
Hello, how are you doing?
Very well. Thank you very much for joining us, Sergeant Minan.
Yes, no problem.
Can you tell us about that day? Again, was this a complete surprise? Did you have any warning that the ambush was ahead, that you were in a difficult area?
Well, I can't really say that we saw it coming or anything. It's just like one of those gut feelings, I guess, because I knew something, just by the way the people were acting that morning, that it was a little bit different. And I remember calling back to the guys that, you know, to keep their eyes open, just because just a bad feeling, I guess. And but other than that, yeah, it was just a real blindsiding an experience, so to speak.
And at this point, yourself, Tristan Watt, and Eric Castro are all back in the U.S. You each lost a leg in those few seconds. Tell us about how the military came in to scoop you up after the ambush.
Well, you know, with three of us were laying down in the bottom of the track, you know, we just wasn't as hectic, I guess, is what I thought something like that would be. Tristan and I just kind of, we grabbed each other, and we just told each other we were going to live, and we talking to Eric Castro as well. Mm-hmm. And they got us back. It took about 15-20 minutes, I think, to get back to where we were based at. And then
were you taken out by helicopter or by another vehicle?
Oh, yeah. They had a chopper come in to where we were based at, and they picked us up from there. Mm-hmm. And then from there, they flew us up to Baghdad, which took another 15 minutes or so.
Sergeant Minan, how quickly did the three of you come to understand what had happened, that you had actually lost limbs in those few seconds?
It was really quick. Other than the first couple seconds, I mean, I thought I tried to massage my foot back. It felt like I'd gone to sleep, and then it dawned on me, you know, that it wasn't there. So I put it down, but I mean, all of us knew right away what had happened, and I don't know, we just instantly, I guess, either cope with it or you just kind of freak out and you don't know what to do. And
right. Not a good day. What happened then once you were back to Baghdad? How long were you there? Did you then go on to Germany or back to the States? What was the process?
Well, from there we got to Baghdad, and we all went in for our initial surgery to get the wounds cleaned out and do the amputations. And I was in Germany a day and a half, 2 days, as well as Tristan was, I believe. And we came back not on the same flight, and Sergeant Castro, he was over there for about a week, I think, before he got to come back to the States. And then from there, I was in Walter Reed 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. And then from there, they gave me the option, you know, staying and doing my prosthetic work or coming home.
And you wanted to get home to your young wife and your young daughter.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't wait. And so I asked the doctors, first of all, I mean, if I was going to get good prosthetic care, I was going to stay there. But they had nothing but good stuff to say about the Denver VA, so I came home to be with my wife and daughter.
It wasn't a perfect breeze getting from Washington to Colorado, as I understand. The military flights are infrequent.
Yeah, they really were. And that's kind of like my only sore spot, really, that
You got stranded in Illinois for something like a week on the way home.
Yeah, I was stuck there, and I didn't understand why at first, because they got me out of Walter Reed, and then that's when the hurricane hit the East Coast. So, I mean, that downed all the Air Force flights. And the guys that were in charge back here in Rear D of the 3rd ACR, they wouldn't allow me to get onto a civilian flight, even though my doctors had okayed it. So I guess I have some questions I have to go ask those guys to figure out what for, but I mean, it's all said and done with now. I got my prosthetic this week, so I'm out walking around.
Have you had it on? How does it feel?
It's actually a lot more comfortable than what I thought. I mean, I walk with a cane a little bit, but it really feels nice, actually.
Mike, this is all still so recent, but how are you coping with it? How are you putting this into the framework of your life? Are you saying to yourself, I signed up to be a soldier. I knew this was potentially part of the deal. It's going to be fine. Or what is
Absolutely.
Your attitude?
That's it. You know, when I joined up the Army, you know, everybody takes the same oath to defend the country from our enemies, foreign and domestic. And you can't be bummed out on something like this. If you do get all bummed out, it's going to eat you alive. So, I mean, I think of all kinds of stupid practical jokes I can play with people and stuff. And you just really got to drive on.
But it's not always easy. You've got a beautiful young daughter I see from the photographs here.
Oh, thank you.
She's gorgeous. She's just terrific. But it can't be easy. I mean, just I know what carrying a child around is, and you've got the crutches at the side now.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's some challenges, but you just got to really push those into the back of your head and realize how lucky you are. I mean, it could have been a lot worse. I'm happy to come out of this, you know. And if they'd let me, I'd go back over there in a second and keep fighting with my guys. You know, this really doesn't set me back at all, I don't think.
That is spirit, and we admire it. Sergeant Mike Minen, thank you very much for joining us this evening with your story.
Yep, no problem. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Mark Thompson, I'm struck with every one of these guys. I mean, they feel lucky to have lived, and both the men we've talked to said they'd go back if they could.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that strikes you last week when I spent some time at Walter Reed. I mean, we do have to sort of keep things in perspective here. Number one, the soldiers who tell Walter Reed they want to speak to the press are self-selected. There are some soldiers who don't want to. And some of the soldiers who spoke with me said, you know, there are guys who don't come out of their rooms. So we do get some sort of a self-selection here. But I think 80 or 90 or 95% of these guys would go back tomorrow if their bodies were intact and could. And it really was, as you suggest, Tom, quite impressive to hear them say that, even when you're saying, well, what about the downsides? What about the downsides? And as Sergeant Minen just says, you just got to drive on.
And yet, Colonel Gross, you know, you've seen firsthand that there is a real price when a body is wounded.
Yeah, there is. These soldiers are outstanding people. They're very committed to their mission. And they truly inspire me as a health care provider.
Are you going to be going back to Iraq, Colonel Gross?
There's a very high likelihood, yes, sir. My next deployment has not been established as yet, but the health care providers will be rotating on a schedule which is yet to be determined.
And you may be through again, and it... From the sounds of things there, sadly, there are no doubt more dead and more wounded to come. Lieutenant Colonel Kirby Gross, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thanks, sir.
Lieutenant Colonel Kirby Gross joined us from Fort Campbell, Kentucky. And Mark Thompson, thanks for your reporting and for sharing it with us this evening.
Sure, my pleasure, Tom.
Mark Thompson, National Security Correspondent for Time Magazine. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.